Welcome and thank you for tuning in. I'm Miriam Azim from Adala, a Palestinian human rights organization and legal center based in Israel. For more details about Adala and our work, please check out the link in the bio of this episode. Today, I'll be speaking with two Adala attorneys, Maisana Morani and Nariman Shadezoabi, about the torture that Palestinians in Israeli prisons are currently facing, especially since October 7th. 8 Palestinians in Israeli custody have already died, with evidence suggesting that at least some are connected to instances of severe violence by Israeli prison guards. We'll have a conversation today about both prison conditions since the 7th of October and widespread instances of torture and ill treatment of Palestinians in detention. So I want to get things going by looking at what those conditions were before going into specific cases and some of the instances that we've seen, but more generally what the conditions are currently and have been since the 7th of October.
So one of the first things that happened immediately at the beginning of the war was to announce emergency situation in the prisons, which meant two things. First of all, that no visits for families were allowed, limitation on visits of lawyers as well. The second thing that happened was a regulation that allowed overcrowdedness in the prisons. This affected mainly the security prisoners because there was a huge amount of arrests. Which led to a situation where many of the prisoners were held without beds, only with mattresses on the floor, and sometimes not efficient even. So we have the overcrowdedness, limitation, preventing visits with family, and the prisoners anyway are not able to call their families. They are not allowed, so no contact with the families at all. And limitation on the visits of the lawyers, which actually created a black hole with no one knowing actually what is happening within the prisons.
Yeah, and I guess that is exacerbated by the fact that also ICRC and other oversight mechanisms that were in place prior to October 7th have also been cut out. So I think that's another aspect.
Exactly. And yani, speaking of our experience as human rights defenders, as lawyers at the beginning of the war, we know that there was around 6,000 prisoners and security prisoners within the Israeli prisons. Nowadays, we know that the official number speaks about 9,000 prisoners within the Israeli prison, Palestinians prisoners. At the beginning of the war, we were challenged to try to figure out what's really happening inside the prisons in order to somehow try to challenge it in front of courts or any other legal avenue possible. But we were faced with lack of information since the communication of the prisoners with the outside world was cut off with the beginning of the war. There were very few testimonies about what's going on. No ICRC was allowed to visit, as Maisana said, no families and no lawyers. Lawyers were prevented from visiting the prisoners. And when we tried first to submit a petition against the halt of the electricity, the water, and preventing the prisoners to leave the cells, we could not have any affidavits from the prisoners because we were not allowed to visit them, and prisoners themselves were so afraid of sharing information and testifying in front of courts because they were afraid of the consequences of sharing these information and the brutality that they could be faced with within the prison. And this was one of the challenges for us as lawyers, human rights defenders, to try to get the situation more normal within the prisons.
So I want to go back a second, because you did mention the water and electricity, and I think those are really, really important topics, because really, with the right after October 7th, they essentially stopped electricity during most of the day, and stopped hot water for showers and prevented access to water overall. Was that challenged somehow?
It was. First of all, we tried to approach the IPS itself.
So the IPS is the Israeli Prison Services.
Yeah, exactly. And then when we had no answers, we went to a court. But unfortunately, we were denied at court over procedural reasons. We still could not challenge many other aspects related to prisoners' lives within prisons in the Israeli courts, either for procedural reasons or for other reasons. Most of the petitions that were submitted since the 7th of October were denied for so many reasons, and we can provide some examples in this talk about how the court is dealing with all these prisoners' issues brought in front of it.
So maybe it's worth expanding a little bit about that. So the first try that the human rights organization had was to approach the Supreme Court asking to cancel the policy of the IPS, and the minister to challenge the policy of the IPS on this regard. And this petition was denied on the basis of lack of factual grounds, exactly because we couldn't meet with the prisoners and have testimonies, or that our testimonies were taken in a different periods, and we couldn't prove that there is a, that the court find a way to get out from discussing the petition based on this factual lack of factual ground. And then they said that we have other option, going in a specific petitions, a prisoner's petitions in the name of a prisoner, a specific prisoner who's facing these difficulties, and not to claim against the policy that the IPS denied. And then actually we tried that also. Personally, I submitted a petition in the name of a prisoner asking to give him clothes. I remember like meeting him in the late November, wearing summer clothes and waiting for asking for to get a jacket, and after getting out from the prison, I just submitted a petition demanding to the IPS to give him a jacket, or to allow me to enter a jacket for him. And the hearing in the petition, it was a month and a half after submitting the petition itself. And when I got to the hearing, between other reasoning, the main reason to reject the petition was that a month and a half has passed, and the IPS now claim that he has a jacket, in a way that I can't confirm this information because I can't meet him, and the next meeting that I have with him is for another 3 weeks. And meanwhile, I don't know if it's actually happened, but because the IPS said the court find a way to dismiss the petition. It's creating in a way a whole loop. We're not accepting any challenge to the policy. Go challenge the each case by itself, and then I don't get remedies for the cases. And actually, the other argument why the petition, the prisoner petition, was rejected was because this policy was approved by the Supreme Court when they didn't intervene. So it's creating a situation where I actually don't get any legal remedies. And it happened with other human rights organizations who tried to submit these prisoner petition and were also denied.
So I want to cover a bit of the testimonies that we received and some of the types of abuse that we're currently seeing. We're seeing widespread torture and physical abuse that is often accompanied by verbal abuse. We've received reports and documented cases involving IPS personnel punching, kicking Palestinians, hitting them with clubs. That is mostly in areas, very strategic areas inside prisons where there aren't any cameras. So people are being pulled out of their cells and places where there is documentation that is supposedly there in order to make sure that they're not subject to this type of violence, into very known areas that both the detainees and the guards are very well aware of. They're being taken to places where that are undocumented, and then we're seeing there very, very severe instances of abuse. We've seen serious and visible injuries. We've seen bruises, fractures to ribs, broken and fractured nose and teeth, which I don't have to say, but it is really a grave violation of the absolute prohibition of torture and ill treatment. The prohibition on torture is not, it's an absolute prohibition. There is no exception to it. And this definitely constitutes a very, very severe violation. We're also seeing instances of sexual assault, harassment, and intimidation. We're seeing both female and male detainees being assaulted and being intimidated, being threatened with rape, being directed with sexual slurs, and several prisoners reported of witnessing instances of sexual assault. We're also seeing many tactics that concern with how to make sure that those instances of violence are not being reported. So we're seeing instances where, and tools being employed by IPS personnel in order to silence detainees. There was a case where detainees were told that IPS had eyes in the court, or that another prisoner had already died, so be careful, nobody's asking about him. So we're seeing a lot of instances where Palestinians in detention are being silenced intentionally to not report their torture, to not report their abuse, which is extremely severe. And the fact that Israeli authorities have received a copy of these testimonies and have really done nothing to address them really goes a lot to how much Israeli authorities are not caring and putting in any care into Palestinian lives and how much they matter. So I want to speak about a bit about Palestinian citizens of Israel, that many of them have been charged with the expression-related charges under the counterterrorism law. So, Maisana, can you speak a bit to it and what that means in the broader context?
Yes. So this time, actually, we saw a huge increase in the use of the freedom of expression, so-called crimes, incitement, or terrorism, actually, under the contra-terror law, including Palestinian citizens of Israel or residents of East Jerusalem. We're speaking around 140 cases. People were indicted with crimes of around freedom of expression, mainly incitement to terrorism. And these crimes are defined in a very wide way that can include anything, actually, and it's used in a very discriminatory way as a tool, and it was used specifically from the 7th of October as a tool to silence Palestinians in general, even silence any protest or any calls to stand with the people of Gaza, with the civilians of Gaza also, were silenced, and the criminal charges played a huge role in this silencing policies. So back to the criminal charges, there was also a change in the policy of the persecution, where they demanded to hold into detention till the end of the procedures everyone who was almost everyone who was indicted. So the persecution asked to held in detention till the end of the procedure everyone who has been indicted with these felonies, and we saw a lot of cases of really young people who published one post in Facebook or even on a WhatsApp group with their friends that the state received many times, sometimes also through their universities, and decided to have criminal charges against these young people. And and the minute that they were detained under this contra terror law, they were held within this within the security prisons, which again mean that they are held in the worst situation possible. They are not getting the same rights as criminal detainees. No family visits. In general, they are not getting the option to have any phone calls with their families. This is the normal situation, but during this emergency, they even didn't get any visits from the families, and a lot of and the lawyers had a huge difficulties meeting with them, which clearly will affect their defense in the legal cases, but also will leave them vulnerable to the whole situation and abuse within the prison.
There was one very, very clear case that you represented in with a testimony of severe abuse. Can you speak about to it?
One of the things that was mentioned in the affidavit was related to the death of one of the of another prisoner. Where our client mentioned clearly that this prisoner was hit, was beaten by the prison guards, and that all the prison heard him for 2 or 3 days yelling that he is in pain and that he's asking for a medical treatment, and that he kept yelling till eventually he yelled no more, and apparently he died. These testimonies we were able to hear only because our client, the detainee, came to the court and was able to speak to the judge and to clarify the things that he has been facing and seeing that others are facing. And I can just imagine what else is happening
وخلونا في الوسط في البيت 4 ساعات وحطونا كمان في غرفة جوا عندنا خلونا في الدبابات خبط فينا نهارين واحنا شايفين الدير من نهار وخبط فينا والله ذبحونا كلهم يخبط فينا واحد يستلم واحد دب هذا تاع الحماس دب بطل رمونا في المية في الحجار في الغلاصة.
Yeah, so this incredibly difficult legal situation, we got to a situation where after a few months and being allowed to visit prisoners a bit more often, a lot of human rights organizations encountered a lot of testimonies of abuse and torture and ill treatment. And recently we submitted a report to the Special Rapporteur Against Torture and Ill Treatment, together with a few other organizations, the Public Committee Against Torture, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, and Hamoked, where we really paint a picture from all organizations and all testimonies collected and other lawyers that have been able to somehow receive testimonies, that really paints a picture of widespread torture across, well, in the submission itself, it was 7 prisons, but actually we're seeing it all across the country.
Which actually led to a few cases where prisoners were killed or died in prison.
And the autopsies says clearly that there was signs of abuse on their bodies after their deaths. Apparently they were killed out of torture.
Yeah, there was actually one case that we learned of where a prisoner where the state actually admitted, acknowledged the fact that there was an incident whereby 15 to 20 prison guards violently attacked a prisoner, and that happened, I believe, a day or two before his death, if I remember correctly, which is something that is absolutely, like, we can't grasp how that is a state admission that then didn't lead yet to any criminal investigation that we know of.
And I'm speaking of the history of accountability within the IPS, the statistics for the past years shows that there was almost no accountability within the IPS, no officials were held accountable for any of the crimes they committed against prisoners. And we know that many of the prisoners who face crimes choose not to testify against them, and it means that few of the crimes are reported, and even these few, none of them leads to any serious criminal procedures.
Yeah, actually, I want to get into it a bit more because the statistics are really staggering. I mean, from actually the Knesset issued research and information report back in November 2023. So it's very, very, very recent, and it covers the last few years as to do with supposed accountability mechanisms of the Israeli prison services. And of all complaints and cases opened between 2019 to 2021, 96 were closed with no measures taken against anyone. And for those opened during 2022, 91% of all cases were immediately closed. And then the vast majority of the cases that were not closed did not result in any criminal proceedings taken against individual Israeli prison services guards. So it's really staggering to learn how little remedy there are for Palestinian prisoners who undergo ill treatment and torture, which isn't new. You know, it didn't start in October 7th. It's something that has been documented thoroughly, and so has the lack of accountability surrounding it.
Yeah, and this immunity that the guards feel let them feel free to act in any way they find it acceptable against prisoners, especially after the 7th of October.
Yeah, this brings me back again to the whole this black hole situation, where it's not only because we don't have access, we can't speak or visit the prisoners. They are not being they are denied the right to come physically to the court. They are participating in the court hearings only through a video conference, while they are surrounded by guards, which also allow a situation where everyone is afraid to speak. I don't know if anyone is giving a testimony what he's gonna face immediately right after the video conference is ending. In this situation, there is no, beside the normal situation of unity, we're in a situation that we don't even have the tools to challenge and to know exactly what is happening. And it's maybe sometimes also important to mention that many of the of these practices or humiliation practicing is also hard to, it's embedded within the day-to-day life of the prison, that we can if we have like physical signs on the prisoners, sometimes the or a situation of death, so the system need to have an answer or need to try to figure out what happened, even it doesn't lead to anything. But many of the day-to-day routine and practices that are is even considered as torture or humiliation are just escaping these all mechanisms of accountability.
Yes, yeah. Speaking of a very similar black hole, and even a more horrifying one, it reminds me of the big issue of what are being now classified as illegal combatants, prisoners. It's a separate category of the security prisoners. These are all Gazan prisoners. We don't know what are the exact circumstances where these were incarcerated. We don't know what the exact numbers of them. Some testimonies say that there are even female prisoners within them, and even minors among these unlawful combatant as classified by the Israeli law. And it's related to another petition that Adala, among other institutions, submitted to the Israeli court 3 weeks ago. First of all, trying to understand the numbers of these prisoners, the place where they are being held, the medical conditions of these prisoners, since we've heard testimonies about some deaths among them, and it's something that the state should provide its initial response to this petition by the 11th of March. And one aspect of this petition is related to the unprecedented procedural violation where these prisoners are not allowed to meet a lawyer for the period of 6 months for now, due to amendment that passed in the Knesset at December 2023. And it's another aspect of the law that we're trying to challenge by the petition. The youngest among the
Palestinian children released by Israel in the hostage exchange deal. His mother also said that during his hospital stay, he was subjected to harsh and punitive treatment. They prevented the nurse from even feeding him. The police officers deliberately turned off the lights in his room during the day so that his family would not see him, and turned them on at night to disturb him while sleeping.
Yeah, so we're all seeing horror pictures from Gaza of the Israeli military picking up and detaining. I don't even know if I can say that is detention, because that feels more like kidnapping than anything else. But we're really seeing a lot of Palestinians from Gaza being brought into Israel and being detained in horrific conditions. There are a few ad hoc military facilities, one that we know of that is the Tayman, which is in the south. And they're all being held under this law and amendment that Nariman just mentioned, which is the Unlawful Combatants Act. And the amendment back in December talked about extending the periods where both judicial oversight, meeting with attorney, and even having a detention order can be denied, essentially. So the law says that all of those detainees can be held without any legal basis for up to 45 days. So that means that a certain military personnel of a certain rank that is specified within the amendment, if they believe that that person is classified as an unlawful combatant, which has no evidence behind that belief, because that is a personal classification and absolute discretion in it, then they can issue what is called as a temporary detention order, which is not a thing that has any equivalence in the criminal procedure. And before the amendment, that used to be for 96 hours. It is now for 45 days. That means that a person can be held without any legal grounds, even not secret evidence, which I know that, like, are extremely problematic and oppressive, and but very explicitly being held without any legal basis for up to 45 days, as Nariman said, subject to certain court approvals, having 180 days without meeting a lawyer, which is really an unprecedented violation of the right to access a counsel, which is also a cornerstone in trying to prevent torture and preventing ill treatment. So that removes another guarantee that should be there. And just a bit about that classification of unlawful combatants, that is something that Israel relies on. So the original law before the amendment was upheld by the Supreme Court, and it essentially creates a classification that is completely illegal under international law. So international law allows for detainees under international humanitarian law, so in the context of hostilities, it allows for detainees to be held or to be classified as prisoners of war, which Israel does not recognize. And then they're afforded certain protections under international law, or protected persons, which are essentially civilians. So Israel created this like interim classification that offers no protection under the law, which was upheld by the Supreme Court, much like a lot of other extremely oppressive laws that affect Palestinians. But yeah, that's the main legal basis upon which we're seeing hundreds or maybe even thousands of Palestinians from Gaza being held in Israel under.
So yeah, exactly, Miriam, what you were describing, even for a law that was legislated back in 2002, and the Supreme Court did not intervene back then. And now we see this draconian amendment from December 2023. And I will allow myself to say that, yeah, we did petition against it, but I know that our chances of succeeding in front of the Israeli court are not high at all, due to the political condition that we are in nowadays, and due to the approaches of this Israeli Supreme Court for the last period. So maybe now we, as lawyers, we may find international advocacy more helpful for us than initiating legal procedures domestically within the Israeli courts.
Yeah, I totally agree that prisoners are always a vulnerable group during emergency situation, like we have seen now and even earlier with the COVID, the prisoners are becoming a more vulnerable a group that are so easy to target by the authorities and to violate their rights, and they normally don't get any remedies from the courts. And specifically this time, it was even a much clearer situation when you have a minister, the Minister of National Security, Ben-Gvir, who decided even before the 7th of October to target the group of the Palestinian prisoners and to try different tools to make their life even harder and to violate their rights, and as an ideology, actually, not only as a matter of emergency. It's an ideology that aim to violate the rights of the prisoners. And in this situation, we're seeing how easy to keep this group without any protection. This situation is leading to all the testimonies that we heard, and actually to the situation where we have already many people who died within custody.
Thank you so much for this very insightful conversation. Before we end this episode, don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast in whatever app you're listening to. That's all until the next episode.